if you look at where we left off last week, we're talking about learning from Jesus how to live. We got halfway through the material, so we've got some passages, page 65, A, B, C, D, and E. And when we think about Jesus, we have here as far as the heading, who were some of the less fortunate people whom Jesus helped, as seen in each of the following scriptures. When we think about the Lord, he was someone who was comfortable interacting with people at virtually every level in life. He dealt with the rich, he dealt with the poor, he dealt with the very educated, he dealt with the people who didn't have much education. And here you see, with these five passages, Jesus interacting with a very wide range of people. Let's get our helpers lined up. First, from Luke chapter 17, we'll look at verses 11 through 14. Luke 17, 11 to 14, who wants to be a reader there? All right, Don. And then we'll take a look at Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 8. Mark 5, 1 to 8. Carol. Then we'll go over to Mark chapter 2, look at verses 10 to 12. Mark 2, 10 to 12. All right, Lois, thank you. John 9, 6 and 7. John 9, 6 and 7. All right, Maxine, thank you. And then finally from Mark chapter 7, verses 32 through 35. Mark 7, 32 to 35. Brian, was that you? Okay, thank you. All right, let's go back to Luke chapter 17, look at verses 11 through 14. Who was sort of down and out and Jesus helped?
And it came to pass as he went through Jerusalem one day that he passed through in the midst of Samaria and Galilee. And as he entered into a certain village, there met him 10 men that were lepers, which stood afar off. And they lifted up their voices and said, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. And when he saw them, he said unto them, go shew yourselves unto the priests. And it came to pass that as they went, they were cleansed.
Thank you. Anybody ever gone to the doc with somebody that was sick and maybe you yourself were not feeling that well? And you ask the doc, you know, you need to see him or her or whoever that might be. And hey, by the way, since I'm here, I'm not feeling too great, see me too. Anybody ever done that? All right. Well, you know, it's kind of a twofer thing. You know, it happens sometimes. I'm sick, so I'm already here, so I want you to take a look at me, and I want you to fix me up too. Well, if you ever do that to a doc, you're probably going to get one of those cockeyed looks like, are you kidding? I've already got a schedule, and you know we're going to have to pull the chart and all those other things. Well, here, if there had been one leper, that would have been quite a bit, but there's not just one. How many are there? There are 10. Can you imagine that? 10 people. Now, somebody says, well, they all had the same disease. That's true, but you still have 10 separate cases. And there's this other interesting item as well. If you did what I just proposed a couple of minutes ago with the doc, hey, by the way, doc, how would that generally work with the doc? If you were the doc, how would you treat two people like that? In fact, if you have multiple patients, how does the doc or the surgeon act? Well, you're going to have to deal with one and then the other, right? You're not going to deal, I'm going to use my right arm here and I'm going to use my left arm there. It just doesn't work like that. But how does Jesus heal these 10? Does he have to heal them one by one? Joe, Sam, Bill? It's just one full swoop.
He tells them not to do the same thing.
Yeah. So it's very amazing. When you think about Jesus, the power that he has, how he healed people, it really is amazing, especially if you try to compare it to what we experience in our day and time. So 10 people, they had this dreaded disease, there was no cure, and Jesus heals them and heals them without charge. Additional thoughts over Luke 17 before we move on to our second verse.
Brad, they still have leprosy. There's still colonies with leprosy.
Yes. Yes, and I've never visited one, but I have read descriptions of them. And if you have people who have that disease in an advanced stage, they can lose body parts. For example, you might see people with no nose, those kinds of things. So it is, right, no fingers. It is a dreaded disease. So if you have this, it's really bad. Now, we don't know exactly how far along these fellows were, but definitely they were in the hands-off category, and they'd been separated from the walks of life that they wanted to be with. So that was bad enough by itself. The separation, the health issues also were a major obstacle for them. Very, very bad problem. And like I say, Jesus able to heal them all. Anybody else?
The comment that the one that came back to thank him was a Samaritan, does that mean that the others were probably Jews?
That's how that's generally understood, and that would be how I understood it. For the people in that day and time, that would have been almost unthinkable. It kind of goes back to the parable of the Good Samaritan, where, you know, you've got the others who are not Samaritans, the Jews, and it's just like, wow, you're holding this guy up. And it was a powerful lesson for the Jews who heard it. But that would be how I would understand that. Tris?
They weren't healed until they obeyed him. He told them to go.
Yes.
As soon as they went, they were cleansed. So had they stood there and said, well, or questioned him.
Yeah. Faith was required. But still, he heals them all at once. And it's just amazing that, you know, as they go, he doesn't have to go and personally inspect them and say, well, okay, there's this for you and this for that. But yes, you're absolutely right. All right. Pass it, Sherman.
Verse 14, right?
Are we back in Luke 17?
Yes.
Okay.
It says that they went. He told them to go see the priest, and so it was. They were cleansed. It doesn't necessarily say they're all cleansed at one time. Or am I looking at this wrong?
Well, I would say that's a fair inference from the text. I mean, let's see how we've got it in a couple of translations. Okay. Let's see how we have it in the SV.
It says, as they went, they were cleansed.
Yeah.
So they may not have turned around.
Okay. I guess the point that I would be looking, they went, and as they went, they were cleansed. So if they're going as a group, which is how I would understand that, at least from the ASV, as they're going as a group, they're also being cleansed. Yeah, that still wouldn't, in and of itself, though, say when they were cleansed.
Well,
you could go back and argue, I think, the point that Sherman was asking about, and that is, at what point were they cleansed?
Well, somewhere in the time that they left him to go to the priest, it was in that time, it says, because as they went, they were cleansed.
Yeah, and that's why I say, as they went, that sounds like the group,
Yeah. They
were cleansed. Right. So that's why I say, here's an example of inference. Now, might you be able to squeeze out there that, you know, as they went, it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10? Possibly. Or was it as they went, it was just bang. They were all instantly cleansed at the very same second.
I don't think it
matters. It doesn't. But, yeah. But you have a group going, you have a group healing. So that's why I say I think it's fair to infer in this particular case that it was one event.
So they were healed on the way to see the priest?
Yes, as they went. Which goes back to the point that Teresa was making. It was an act of faith.
Okay.
Anybody else? Let's pick up with our Mark reference. This is going to come from Mark chapter 5, we said, verses 1 through 8.
And they came to the other side of the sea and to the country of the... How do you say that word?
Is it Gerasenes? Thank you. Teresa would have been a far better doctor than I would have been for a couple of reasons. One reason is that she can look at some of the stuff that you see pictured maybe on TV as far as a medical person, or you see maybe as someone who's doing an autopsy, and that is just not my thing. I can stand some of that, but there are some things where I would just say it's best to turn that over to somebody else. Not that I'm going to faint, but that is just really not my forte. As you think about doctors, do you think there may be some times where they look at something and they think, boy, you know, we really don't want to get involved with that. We're looking at that, and yikes, I'd prefer somebody else to handle that.
And they do it, too. They send you to a specialist.
Yeah, they do. Can you imagine going up to somebody who was demon-possessed? I think that would be a little creepy. I mean, when you've got the people that are cutting themselves, you have people, for example, maybe trying to cast themselves into a body of water, cast themselves into a fire. That's some scary stuff. Remember, you also have some information in the Bible about demons. They were sufficient to allow people to break the chains. You got some guy that you can chain up, put some handcuffs on and some leg irons on, if we put that into modern terminology, and the guy can just break them. Think he could snap your neck? Let's try it again. Think he could snap your neck? I would imagine that probably wouldn't be too much of a difficulty for him. So you're around those people, and that's a little unsettling. And yet Jesus, how does he respond to the people? He doesn't run away. Just like the lepers. I'm not afraid of you. You have a problem, I'm going to have compassion. I'm going to cure you. I'm going to help you. We're going to take care of the issue. So here, 10 lepers, Luke chapter 17, Mark chapter 5, demon possession. Anything on that? Gary?
When it says that the guy saw Jesus from afar off and ran to him, so if you could imagine a possessed person running at you, charging you,
yeah.
The last thing you want to do is just stand there and wait and see what he's going to do.
Yeah, in our day and time especially. There was a police officer. I had a question for him. Teresa and I were discussing something, so he pulled in at Lowe's. That was on Sunday afternoon. I stopped there to hopefully accomplish a couple things, and I saw him pull in, waited a few minutes, and this guy gets out of the police car and is not dressed in a police uniform. So I'm assuming that unless he's still in the car, he's an off-duty officer. Well, given all that's happened over the last week or so, I thought the last thing that I want to do is run up and charge the guy. So, well, I mean, really, he had a bunch of tattoos on him. So when he was from here about to where the exit would be, I just, you know, I was dressed in a suit, so I figured that was probably helpful to my cause. I just said, hey, are you an off-duty officer? And even from back there, I mean, he starts to study me like, okay, is this guy a threat? Is he coming for me? I got a little closer and still kept a little distance until I started this conversation and made it clear as far as what my intentions were. And he still studied me all the way up to the door as we talked. And he was more than happy to answer my questions. But, I mean, still, it was one of the deals where you are involved in that kind of thing, and it is a little unsettling, even today. So, good thought. Anybody else? Okay, let's take a look at passage 3, Mark chapter 2, verses 10 to 12. Okay, so 10 lepers, demon possession. Now in Mark chapter 2, verses 10 to 12, what's the issue? There's this guy who is paralyzed. And for a lot of people, they would say, well, we don't want to be involved with that. I mean, if we can help move him somewhere or get something for him. But as far as trying to deal with him, that is way out of our league. A surgeon might try something, but that would probably be about as much as could be done. Even physical therapy may not be too helpful. But Jesus, once again, no problem. I'm willing to heal him. I have that ability, and that's exactly what he did. John 9, 6 and 7.
When he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay, and said unto him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is by interpretation sent. He went his way therefore and washed and came seeing.
Okay. Someone who's blind, what's our response to that in our society? I mean, not that his vision's bad, the guy can't see. So society says, well, we'll get you a seeing eye dog. We'll get you a cane. We will get you the best that we have as far as technology, but don't expect us to do what for you? Don't expect us to restore your sight. Was Jesus thinking in terms of a cane or seeing eye dog? No. I've got the power. I've got the authority. So demons, leprosy, paralysis, blindness. And then as we look at Mark 7, verses 32 to 35, let's see what else we have.
And they bring unto him one that was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they beseech him to put his hand upon him. And he took him aside from the multitude and put his fingers into his ears, and he spit and touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and saith unto them, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. And straightway his ears were opened, and the string of his tongue was loosed, and he spake plain.
Okay, a lot of people have had speech problems over the years. You find stutters, you find sometimes, maybe it's in the early years, maybe it's in later years, people go to reach for a word and they can't put their mind to what that word is, or they forget the word, whatever it might be. So speech problems, less of a problem than blindness, less of a problem than deafness, but Jesus was able to do that, and how much therapy did the guy need?
None.
I mean, there have been some old techniques. I think some of them are still used. You probably heard about the fellow who was told to put rocks in his mouth and, you know, rattle them around a little bit and try to talk around the rocks, and that was going to help him, and they've done other things as far as therapy, but Jesus did not require the fellow to have any therapy. That was not necessary. And then what was the other issue? He was also deaf, couldn't hear. Well, that is still a major issue in our world. That, like blindness, is going to affect a life in a very negative way. We, like blindness, have some ways that we can deal with that. But as far as one day a person can't hear, and then being able to say, okay, here you can hear now, unless there's some kind of very special surgical technique, that likely will never be accomplished. Anything that you might want to ask before I start looking at some other passages? Dolores, is that you? Yes.
That's one thing that the kids at the school for the deaf have to really work on. And this could have been something different, but it could have been from that.
Yeah, if people can see and they can hear, but they end up with some kind of speech impairment, they're generally not very happy about that, because for the most part, I think people probably speak and speak pretty well. But you're right, if you do have the other issue as far as a hearing issue, speech impediment, very well may be something else that you suffer from. So assuming in this case that they were connected, the fella really had a difficult time for the period when those medical issues existed. Anybody else? Gary?
I don't know how recent it is, but I know it's somewhat fairly recent that they can implant something into a
right.
person's head so they can hear again. And so then you see the video of them hearing for the first time and just how amazing it is for that person. I can't imagine what it would be like for this guy and then going around and telling who did it for him.
Yeah. Well, society recognizes the importance of that. If you think back to the Star Trek series that was back in the 1970s, you've got William Shatner, and then the newer one that came out as well, you've got Geordi, remember the visor? Supposedly couldn't see. So it was important enough, even in that series, to put in there something that could help him deal with a lack of sight. So society recognizes that. Let's find a tool, or let's find surgery. We may not be able to fix it. We certainly can't get it back to what it should be, but at least we can go ahead and help with the impairment so a person can have at least partial hearing, partial sight, those kinds of things. But yes, you're right, that people will go to great lengths, spend a lot of money to hear and see. Anybody else? Okay. Let's move down a little bit. Luke chapter 14, verse 12. We'll also look at verse 13 and verse 14. Then Matthew 19, 16 to 22, and at the bottom of the page, Mark chapter 1, verses 40, and I think down to 41 will be sufficient. Luke 14, 12, and then you'll also read 13 and 14. Who wants to be lined up for that? Sherman, Gary will ask you to take Matthew 19, 16 to 22, and Mark 1, 40 and 41. Who wants to be our helper there? Mark 1, 40 and 41. Jeff?
Yes.
Okay. All right, let's go back to Luke chapter 14. We'll start with verse 12.
Then he also said unto them who invited him, when you give a dinner or a supper, do not ask your friends, your brothers, your relatives, nor rich neighbors, lest they also invite you back, you be repaid.
Okay, here's the question. We learn that Jesus went into the house of one of the chief Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath day. From verse 12, which Sherman just read, tell whom Jesus told the Pharisee not to invite to dinner or supper?
Everybody would have.
All right, your friends. Basically, the people that you get along with. Why? What's the reason for that?
They can repay you.
All right, they can repay you. It's not really necessarily you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, but you know, we're friends and you can do this for me, I can do this for you, and maybe one is even nicer than the other. From verse 13, Sherman, would you read that as well?
But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind.
Okay, Jesus said, invite whom? Invite the poor, invite the maimed, invite the lame. Why?
They can't pay you back.
All right, they can't pay you back. If you really want to be kind to somebody, if you really want to show hospitality, then do it for people that are
not able to pay you back.
All right, not able to pay you back. And that's going to help really show your intentions, your motivations. And then verse 14, if you'd read that too.
And you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just.
Okay. When you look at non-Christians, do you think they treat their friends well?
Yes.
I think that's generally true. and they probably get good treatment in return. When you look at the non-Christian, does he, she, do they have much incentive to treat the poor, the maimed, the blind well? No. And they're generally not interested in them for what reason? You can't do anything for me. You can't help me. You can't reciprocate, so we're not all that interested in you. But Jesus said, if we are one of his people, we're interested in all people, regardless if they can help us, pay us back, whatever that might be. Thoughts on that before we pick up with Matthew 19? All right, let's take a look at Matthew 19, starting with 16 and going down through 22.
And behold, one came and said unto him, Good Master, what good thing shall I do that I might have eternal life? And he said unto him, Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one, that is God. But if thou wilt enter into life, keep the commandments. He saith unto him, Which? Jesus saith, Thou shalt do no murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness. Honor thy father and thy mother, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. The young man saith unto him, All these things have I kept from my youth up. What lack I yet? Jesus said unto him, If thou wilt be perfect, go and sell what thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me. And when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions.
Okay, now let's start at the end of what Gary read. This man goes away feeling what?
Sorrowful.
Great grief, sorrow. And the reason is given. He went away sorrowful because he had great possessions. Question, could he have helped the poor with those great possessions? Didn't have to sell everything he had? I mean, if you've got a lot of money, you can dig a little bit into the bank account and say, well, okay, we might take 2%, 5%, 10%, 20% off the savings. And if you've got great possessions, you've still probably got a pretty good amount of assets. So would you say from that the problem was he wasn't giving to the poor? Or it was really in another area?
He loved his stuff.
He loved his stuff more than God, more than anything else. So it wasn't he was maybe a bad giver, but it was, he said, this is what I want. And material goods are going to be the most important thing to me in life. Jesus tries to get at the heart of the problem by saying, sell all you have. And for him, he made it clear that that's where his heart was. He was not willing to do that. Sherman?
The New King James says, sell what you have. I don't know if that really means all that you have. So, but other versions may say something.
Do we have all in some other translations?
No, King James just says, go and sell what that thou hast.
Okay.
It doesn't say the word all, but it does say to sell what that thou hast.
Anybody have the New King James and the New American Standard? Okay. Okay. Yeah, even in the ASV, it says, sell what thou hast and give to the poor. So,
yeah. I guess we could assume it's all.
So, but that's the wording that you have there in the translations, Don?
New ASV says, sell your possessions and save all.
Okay. Okay. So, if it's not all, then you have to ask the question, what percentage did Jesus have in mind when he said, sell your possessions? I guess if you looked at that in a parallel way, somebody says, empty your house before the move. How would you understand that? It would seem to at least be a significant percentage, maybe the majority. So, okay, let's take a look at Mark chapter 1, 40 and 41.
And there came a leper to him, beseeching him, and kneeling down to him, saying unto him, If thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. And Jesus, moved with compassion, put forth his hand and touched him, and saith unto him, I will be clean.
Thank you. Let's fill in our blank. Jesus was moved with compassion. So he touches the fella and he says, I will. This is consistent with heaven's will, and the miracle occurred. All right, at the bottom of the page, we think about Jesus in terms of his finishing the work that he was sent to do. Admittedly, there were dark hours in the life of our Lord, even before the cross, twice during his ministry. He cleansed the temple. He sternly renounced the hypocritical leaders of his day, bringing upon himself their bitter resentment and their determination to put him to death. He wept when he thought of Jerusalem's impending destruction. That would have been by the Romans about 40 years later. Finally, he went to the cross and gave the last full measure of his life for sins, but not for his own. He died knowing that his own people had rejected him and demanded his death. Those hours on the cross were the darkest the world has ever known, but they were necessary in finishing the work God had given Jesus to do. Today we live because he died. How can we ever thank him enough for his great love and sacrifice? That's exactly right. When you think about what Jesus did, you can go back to all the miracles that we've looked at in this lesson, helped all kinds of people, did it for free, and just time and time again showed great love and great sacrifice on the part of others. He asked, do we grow weary of the work of God? And here are some items as far as good advice from an unknown poet. If a task is once begun, If a task is once begun, never leave it till it's done. Be the labor, great or small, do it well or not at all. That's good general advice. I think, though, when you look at the Christian life, there's a sense in which, do we ever finish with the work? No. I mean, after we became a Christian, we stepped into some work that had been started by others. And when we die, we're going to leave some work, which will hopefully be picked up by others. So you have there, I think, imagery which is consistent with the Lord. He talks about entering into the vineyard. The vineyard's been there for a long time. A lot of people have done great work, maybe a work that's going to be far, far, far greater than what we will ever do. And we have a chance to come in, be a faithful, good, solid, committed worker for a while. And then after we've been there and our life ends, then that vineyard, Lord willing, will still be there and people will continue to work. Thoughts that you have on what we've said thus far? Don? Okay.
Did God thought it was the darkest hour?
I guess in answering that question, I would ask what perspective we're considering that question from.
Well, from the beginning of whatever, you know, God knew that this was going to happen, right?
Yeah.
He orchestrated all those things. Jesus knew it was going to happen. Even though he asked the cup to pass from him. But it's a time really of rejoicing. All the sins that we have were laid on him at the cross. So, you know, on one hand, you bemoan the fact that he had to do that. On the other hand, if he hadn't done it,
that's why I asked about the perspective, which direction that you're looking at that from. If you're looking at it from the fact that there is not going to be that fellowship restored between man and God without the death of cross, then it's not the darkest hour of the cross. If you look at several of our songs, you would not find, I think, in at least a few of our songs, the idea that it was the darkest hour. Now, we might talk about the gloom of the garden and so forth, but up from the grave Jesus arose, that's certainly something that happened because of the cross, and we sing about that in a very positive way. So there was sin that was being paid for at the cross, and I think you have that exemplified by the darkness that came over the land that's discussed there in the last hours of the Lord's life. But from another perspective, the one that you were describing, yes, I would agree that it was a very glorious time as far as what was being done. Terrible way to get it done, but the consequences, the results from that, very, very positive.
I was thinking it wasn't the darkest for Jesus or Christ, because, or God, because death can't claim it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was there for a short time.
It's not a really good analogy, but you think surgery. A person is told that you got to go have surgery. And that they're in the pre-op area. They're thinking about the procedure. And maybe they're still with it as far as being wheeled back. And they hear the attendants talking and so forth. Boy, this is going to be a long one. And maybe get some other information that doesn't sound all that positive on the way back to the operating room. And yet, in the midst of that gloominess, you also are thinking what? I'm going to be able to have my arm restored. I'm going to be able to have the cancer removed. I'm going to be able to go back and have more energy or whatever it might be. So there's that mixture there, that dual thinking, if you will. And I would say that you have the same kind of thing with the cross.
Sin, but we have a way of forgiving him. Before that, there was no in the respect that the sin made it of the world, made it to the point that he had to die on the cross.
Yes, there's a verse, I'm thinking it's in John. Somebody else might be able to find it more quickly than I can. If you got a concordance with the word darkness, that might lead you to it. But Jesus said something along the lines of, the hour of darkness has come, or this is the hour for darkness. I was thinking it was around John 17, but that may not be right. Let's just do a quick look here in the concordance for the ASV and see if that pulls it up. But Jesus specifically talked about that idea and specifically talked about the fact that there was the hour for it, the time, and that would have been in conjunction with the crucifixion. Nobody sees it? Maybe Luke 22:53. Yeah, there it is. Luke 22:53. Jesus said, "When I was daily with you in the temple, you stretched not forth your hands against me. But this is your hour. This is your hour and the power of darkness." So you have there, in addition to what I would consider to be the crucifixion, the crowd that has come to take him. You know, this is your hour, the power of darkness is at hand, that whole process. And that might not be the only passage that we could use, but that certainly would be one cross-reference that I'd offer there, Don, as far as the point that you were making the other side of it. Anybody else? Gary?
Yeah, you just look at the events in a simple manner. You have, they ask to free a murderer and are now crucifying a very innocent person, the most innocent person ever. And as far as like the condition of mankind, that you can't get much any darker than that.
Yeah. And here when we talk about the hour of darkness, we're not talking about a 60-minute period. We're talking about a series of events over a period of about a day, maybe a day and a half. But yes, that's right. That would have been part of the hour of darkness. You've got the crowd coming for Jesus at night, the sticks that were used there, the torches and so forth, the power of darkness, the unjust trials of Jesus, the power of darkness, what happened at the cross, and so forth. So yes, good thought. Anybody else before we pick up with the next section? Okay, let's take a look at what we have after the poem. In the preceding study, we've seen how we can learn from Jesus how to live. As he had a purpose in life, so should we have. As he lived a busy, useful, and meaningful life, we should do likewise. As he helped the sick, the afflicted, we should try to do the same. As he finished the work God gave him to do, that should be true for us. 1 Corinthians 15:58, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. Let's not forget that Jesus is still helping his people, even though he finished the work God gave him to do on the earth as far as man's need for redemption. From the following scriptures, tell us what Jesus is still doing. Let's get these five lined up and take care of them quickly. Acts 2:47, who wants to head over there, Gary? Then we'll take a look at 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, Brian. Hebrews 4, 15 and 16, Sherman. Hebrews 7, verse 25 should be sufficient for the next one. Hebrews 7, verse 25, Jeff. And then 1 Corinthians 15, 25 and 26. 1 Corinthians 15, 25 and 26. Don, thank you. Let's go back to Acts 2 and see what we have in verse 47.
Praising God and having favor with all the people, and the Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved.
Now, we talked about this briefly in the Acts class a little bit, but I am fascinated by this verse. You would think as far as adding someone to the church that it might not be that big of a deal. You might think that Jesus would just give an angel or maybe several angels that responsibility. When somebody needs to be in the church, angel X or angels A, B, and C, you take care of that. But Acts 2:47 says, who adds people to the church? The Lord. Every single person who enters into the body of Christ is personally admitted, the opposite would also be true, or is personally denied by Jesus. That is an amazing fact. But that's what the Bible teaches. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13.
There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that you may be able to bear it.
Okay, when we think about deity, Jesus, as we'll see in a little bit, is making intercession for us. And what he does for us now also helps in regard to what subject? With our temptations, so that we are not tempted beyond the point where we can bear. Hebrews chapter 4, verses 15 and 16.
For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in the time of need.
Okay, now let's go back to Acts 2 for just a second. Acts 2:47. Jesus does what personally? Adds people to the church. Now, if he did that and then said, well, great, you're in the door. If he stopped at that point and just dropped us. Well, I mean, that would be nice. He puts us in. But the Bible says he doesn't stop there. What else does he do? He says, as you're in my spiritual body, as you're in the church, I'm going to help you in what way? 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. I'm going to watch over you. Not only collectively, I think we can infer individually, I'm going to watch over you and help you in what area? With temptation, 1 Corinthians 10, 13. And now from Hebrews 4, verses 15 and 16, what else does he do for us?
Grace and mercy.
All right, he says, I'm going to have grace and mercy. I'm going to be there when you need help. Sometimes that's going to be in a time of temptation, 1 Corinthians 10, 13. But there will also be some other situations. Hebrews 7, verse 25.
Wherefore he is able to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by him, seeing he ever liveth to make intercession for them.
Okay, I'm going to help you after you've been added to my church. I'm going to watch over you with temptation. You can come and seek assistance. And when there are times when you need what from me? Intercession. When you need, what would be another word for that? When you need someone to serve as your
mediator,
another word might be advocate, another word might be
counsel,
lawyer, attorney. When you need legal representation before God, Jesus says, who's going to show up? Me. I put you in my church, and now I'm going to save you, keep you, unless you choose to leave the faith. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 25 and 26.
For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy that will be abolished is death.
All right, so when we think about Jesus, what's he doing now? He's reigning. You think everybody that reigns is concerned about their fellow citizens? I mean, we have plenty of examples of that. As long as my household, the king, the president, whoever it might be, as long as we're fed, as long as we're clothed, as long as we're protected and everything is great, that's all we care about. We don't care about you. Maybe some would go further and they would say we care about the people who are close to us, the court, our advisors, our helpers, maybe the people who are in the upper level of society who may help keep us in power. But the poor people, we don't care about you. What have we learned as far as Jesus and his concern about people when he was on the earth? Remember? Gary? He talked about the fellow who was coming from where? Did he care about that fellow who looked like a crazy person? Yes, he did. Did he care about those 10 lepers? Yes, he did. Did he care about the blind man? Did he care about the deaf? All those people he cared about. And now he says, I still care enough about people. If you're willing to obey me, I'm going to put you where? In my church. And in my church, what am I going to do for you? I'm going to continue to care for you. And do I have the power to care for you? Yes, because what do I do? 1 Corinthians 15, 25 and 26. I reign. I have, to use the words of Matthew 28, 18 through 20, Jesus said, all authority or all power has been given unto me in heaven and on earth. And now tonight we're able to conclude that he uses that power in part to help his people. So it is a great, great thing. And thank God for that. Additional thoughts that you have? All right. Let's dip into lesson 12. This is the last lesson. Learning from Jesus how to die. We've learned from him several things as far as how to live, but let's think about this aspect. A lot of people die well or don't die well. What would you say?
Don't.
What would you add as far as a follow-up point to that answer? Why don't they die well or how do they die poorly?
They're scared.
All right. Some people are scared almost kicking and screaming to the grave. It's, you know, we've got to try this last-ditch medical effort. Give me the trial medicine. Let's try that experiment. I don't care how much it costs. I don't care how painful it is. Just keep me away from death's door. What else? Death. People don't die well. How could we illustrate it?
Because
concern about the loved ones we're leaving behind.
All right. You know, I can't die yet because, and you can fill in the blank, my children are too young, or my spouse is unprepared, or I'm caring for somebody and they need to be they need to continue to receive assistance. So that's true too. Therese?
My grandma was terrified of dying because the Baptist preacher told her she would
go. Okay. Some people are looking at it from an eternal standpoint and they think that they're lost and they believe that once they draw the last breath, they're going to end up in punishment. And that very well may be right. But it's certainly true that some people have that fear. Don? I think you can look at it both ways. I'm thinking primarily as far as a non-Christian, but you are also going to find some Christians who fear death.
Why do they?
Why do they? Well, okay, that's a good question. You asked a good question, let the class answer it.
I'm not sure they're prepared.
All right, there are some people who think, I'm just not sure I'm ready. I don't feel I'm good enough. That might be an answer that some would give. I don't think that's a good biblical answer, but that would be what you find in the minds of some. Why else? Some Christians fear death. All right. I gave this illustration, I think, in a sermon a while back, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing again, but the bottom line was, does God own both sides of the river? He does. We're on this side of the river now, thinking about river as the death experience. Does he own the other side? Yes, he does. Remember what we talked about from lesson 11. Christ has how much authority? All authority over heaven, earth. He personally adds us to the church. And if he's continuing to care for us as we go through life, wouldn't we be able to infer that he's also going to care for us when we go through the death process? Yes. It's not going to be that he says, well, okay, you're dying or you're dead. I've stepped away from you. Now it's welcome. I'll see you through that as well. Why else do some Christians fear death?
Pain.
All right. And that is a little more logical, or we can put some more rationale with that than some other reasons, but sometimes it's just, boy, you know, I don't know what's going on and hard to think through this.
I can't
deal with it anymore. So that can be an answer. Anything else as far as a Christian?
In relation to what Judy said, the pain can make a person who's dying not think as clearly.
Yeah.
And so watching my mother, even though she was the most faithful Christian woman I knew, at the end, there was still some concern for her. You know, partly it was leaving me alone, but part of it, too, was thinking about, you know, this is it. I hope, and she knew that when you're sick and your brain is not working exactly the same, it can be a little different.
It can be, and with that, if you're already in great pain, the last thing that you want is to go to another place that has even worse pain. So people can be thinking, you know, this really has me kind of concerned. I really want to make sure I'm right. But that, for many, is driven by pain. All right, let's take a look at some quick items here. We'd like to think about our children, our ancestors, our friends, our occupations, and many other things, and talk about those items, but still not think about, not talk about the subject of death. Though we may avoid the subject of death, we cannot avoid it. Hebrews 9:27 says, for it is what? It is appointed unto man once to die, and then after this comes the judgment. And that's pretty clean, pretty plain and clear. All right, the enemies of Jesus thought that through death they would destroy the Lord or could destroy the Lord, but they were greatly mistaken. On the contrary, his death provided the sacrifice needed to atone for the sins of the world. We've talked about that tonight. Even for the people who put him to death. That is an incredible thought. Jesus' death was not only for the people who we might look at and say or conclude they were good people, they were well moral people, but Jesus even died for the people who plotted against him, and that truly is a marvelous example of God's love. The top paragraph at the top of page 67. Through Christ's death and ours, though they are different in many respects, we should try to follow his example in death. How one dies is determined to a large or great extent by how one lives, and it could not be otherwise with our Lord. No one can understand his death without reflecting on his life. In death, the love he showed toward both friend and foe, the calm disposition under stress, the understanding he had of those who did not understand themselves, these things were typical of his daily life. He never lost control of himself, nor did he lose touch with the common man. Let's, next week, consider some of the lessons that we can learn from his death so we can be better prepared to die.